what I decided to do right then was not focus on looking for a job in that interim period, but focus on researching how to open my own solo practice, how to organize the practice and run it successfully. And so what I really focused on, since I had so much time, was keeping my expenses very low and organizing the practice as well as I could before I even started.
Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Welcome to episode 17 of The Law Entrepreneur. Hi, my name is Neil Tyra, and I'm your host as always. Today, I am delighted to have Nicole Whitaker as my guest. Nicole is a solo practitioner who practices outside the Baltimore area, specifically in Towson's, where she focuses on immigration, trust estates, civil litigation, and family law. She's currently an adjunct professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law, where she teaches legal analysis, research, and writing course for the Law of the United States LLM program. After she graduated from undergrad school at the University of Maryland College Park, my alma mater, she moved to Madrid, Spain, where she taught English in the Madrid public school system. She goes back to the current community by teaching English as a second language for the Community College of Baltimore County. Now, I was delighted to have her as my guest because she's a true solo practitioner at the moment. Although, as you will hear, she's getting ready to hire her first staff member. And what I really liked about her story is she opened her solo practice right out of law school. So heretofore, all of our other guests, our attorney guests who have been on the show, have transitioned from other law firms into solo practice. But Nicole's our first true out-of-law school solo practitioner and shows clearly that that's a viable alternative for those of you who just graduated here this last month. So without any further ado, have a hearty listen to Nicole Whitaker. Hey there, Nicole. Welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Hi, Neil. Good to be here.
Thank you for taking the time to be with me today. Nicole, tell our audience a little bit about your practice and how you came to be a solo practitioner.
Sure. So my practice is in Towson, Maryland. It is mainly immigration. I also do some collaborative family law as well as estate planning and estate administration. The story about how I started, it all started with a flyer that was passed around in Spanish class in college. It was Spanish 203. And in college, I had always wanted to study abroad. And my minor was Spanish. And I really loved the idea of being immersed in a culture and really perfecting my Spanish. So this flyer was promoting a program where you go to Spain and you teach for the Ministry of Education, you teach English. And I thought that was perfect for me because, first of all, I don't have to study and right. I don't have to pay to study abroad. They pay me. So I went to Spain for a year. And when I came back, I started to go to law school. And law school had always been the plan. And while I was in law school, I looked for a part-time job. And because I had taught in Spain English, I decided to look for a job teaching English here in the States. And that's when I started working for the Community College of Baltimore County and teaching English. And What I gathered from that experience was that so many of my students would come to me with legal questions because they knew I was in law school. Being a law student, ethically, I wasn't able to answer their legal questions or give them any advice. I had to point them in the right direction to resources for them or other lawyers. But I realized that those people were my potential client base. Yeah. And during that time when I was in law school, I was interning at the Baltimore Immigration Court. I was working at a law clerk, as a law clerk at a small firm. And everything kind of fell into place, you know. A lot of people, they go into solo practice by necessity just because of the climate of the legal industry out there. It's really tough to find a job, but I really did it by choice. You know, everything led me to opening my own practice. If I hadn't gotten that flyer in Spanish class, I would have never lived in Spain. And if I had never lived in Spain and taught English there, I would have never looked for a job teaching English when I came back to the U.S. and I was in law school. And if I had never taught those English classes here in the U.S., I would have never realized that I had this potential client base, and I would have never taken that leap to open my own practice.
Well, let's circle back a little bit. When you went to Spain, did you come from a Spanish-speaking environment? Or
no, not at all. It is my second language. At this point, you know, I have clients that speak Spanish, and I speak Spanish to them, but it is still my second language.
Right. And then you said that law school was always the plan. What was your vision in terms of going to law school? Where did you see yourself upon graduation?
So, you know, throughout law school, none of my parents were lawyers. I don't have any lawyers in the family. And I really didn't know what type of law I wanted to practice. Growing up, I just saw Law and Order, and I knew that's what I wanted to do.
Right.
And so interning at the Baltimore Immigration Court, that coupled with teaching immigrants really inspired me. You know, I have a love for that community. I have heard so many horror stories from students and now clients who've been taken advantage of. They're a really vulnerable population. Our culture is new to them. The language is new to them. And a lot of people really take advantage of the situation. And I felt like immigration law is where I can do the most good.
And your internship in the immigration court, that was just by happenstance? That happened to be where you got your internship?
Well, I had already been teaching, and so I already kind of had that interest in immigration law. And so interning at the Baltimore Immigration Court just confirmed that I enjoyed the substance of immigration law.
So when you went to law school, you weren't sure what area of law you were going to focus on. Were you of the mind at that point that you were going to have your own practice, or did that come later?
You know, I always kind of saw myself having my own practice, but I never thought it'd be right out of law school. It just happened to be that this was the perfect time in my life. You know, I'm not married. I don't have children. So my budget's low. And by teaching, I still teach, and my teaching contracts brought in enough to support me and to support my practice when I first started. And so all the doors just opened where they needed to open, and it all worked out.
Well, we're going to focus on that in just a second, but I wanted to come back to your observation that Law and Order helped shape your legal career. You know, I went to law school a little later in life. I was so much later that I was the oldest one in my graduating class. And one of the observations that I had in the very beginning was how much television did shape the ideas of budding attorneys and law school students, and how they fell into really one of two camps. Most of them saw themselves as a prosecutor on Law and Order, or they thought of themselves as a solo practitioner. Very few came to law school thinking I could make a career as a corporate attorney or as a counsel to corporations or any of the other variety of legal professions that there are. They most of them fell into the camp of being a prosecutor or being a solo practitioner. So I find that interesting that in your mind, knowing that you wanted to go to law school, you kind of always had your eye from the very beginning on opening a solo practice.
Yeah, in the future, the distant future.
Right. And so your runway to doing so was paved a little bit by the fact that you were able to teach English as a second language, and then you have some other teaching roles, do you not?
That's right. I teach legal analysis, research, and writing at the University of Baltimore School of Law. It's the LLM program for students who already have their law degrees in their home countries. And so they have to spend 1 year learning at a United States law school before they can sit for the bar. So what a perfect population for me to teach. You know, they are immigrants just like my ESOL students at the community college.
Right. So all of these factors are all playing together to help support your exposure to clients who might need immigration services.
Exactly.
So let's talk then a little bit about the steps that you took to open your practice. So you knew you wanted to do that. You graduate from law school. And did you go to the law school in Baltimore?
I did. I went to University of Baltimore School of Law.
What were the things that you had to think about? What were your considerations in opening your own practice?
So I decided really to open my own practice right before I started studying the bar. It was right after graduation. You have that period of about 6 months where you're in limbo. You don't have a license to practice law. You have to study for the bar. And the only kind of job you can get is as a law clerk, either at, you know, a small firm or a big firm, or working at a court. And what I decided to do right then was not focus on looking for a job in that interim period, but focus on researching how to open my own solo practice, how to organize the practice and run it successfully. And so what I really focused on, since I had so much time, was keeping my expenses very low and organizing the practice as well as I could before I even started.
Well, tell us a little bit about what were some of the sources, what were some of the resources that you took advantage of in researching how to open your practice?
So here's the first point I want to make about keeping expenses low. I know other solos that spent probably over $1,000 on books. If you go to Amazon and look up law practice management, it is so easy to spend so much money on these books. But working at the law school, I rented some of the same books right from the law library. I don't know if any of them in particular was more beneficial than any others. I looked at so many books. And also there are a ton of online blogs out there on practice management, as well as search engine optimization. About half of my clients find me just online. And I created my own website, and I did that by doing a ton of research when I first started on how to optimize your website so that it gets up there on Google and so that clients can find you.
Okay, well, let's start at the beginning here. What kind of decisions did you have to make with respect to how you were going to incorporate your law firm? Did you do so as a sole proprietorship, or did you set it up as an LLC, or how did you go about doing that?
I set it up as an LLC. I don't know if it's really necessary, but I just felt like it seemed more professional to set it up as an LLC.
And did you do that yourself, or did you hire a firm to do that for you?
I did it myself.
Okay, so what's involved in doing that?
So there are so many resources out there. What you have to do is create your articles of incorporation. And I saw some templates, and it really isn't as complicated as it seems. That was just another way that I tried to keep my expenses low in the beginning, was to do it myself.
Yeah, I would hope that as a graduating law student that we all could, you know, create that business entity for ourselves and wouldn't have to rely on a third party. But, you know, some people choose to do so. Then how about where to practice? What was the decision process in determining where to open an office or even to open an office?
Yeah, so I really felt like I definitely needed a place to meet people. as opposed to meeting them in my home. First of all, because I live out in the country and it would be tough for anybody to find me. But
and that's also, not where your clients typically are either, are they?
Exactly. Exactly. So I looked at a couple of the cities that had the larger immigrant populations, but where I really landed was where I found a beautiful building with a very small space that had a reasonable rent. It's right next to the Baltimore County Circuit Courthouse. So it's easy to find. Even if there aren't many immigrants right here in Towson, there are plenty in the neighboring areas, and this is an easy place to find.
And so how did you find this location?
So again, lots of preparation. I probably spent about 3 months looking for the perfect office to set up. And finally, I called a pretty large property management firm. And they told me, honestly, we don't have anything as small as what you're looking for, but we have a law firm that's a current tenant that wants to give back some of their space. And so what they did was they built in my unit that was actually part of an existing law firm next door. And so I got to save a little bit there because it's such a small unit in comparison to the other units here in the building. I still have a reception area in my own office, but it's nice and cozy.
Good. And then what about decisions to outfit your office, to equip it, to, you know, buy, you know, office computers and faxes and all that stuff? How did you go about doing that?
So when it came to the regular furnishings, not the technology, Craigslist was my friend because I had 6 months where I knew I was going to open this office. I had so much time to look for the best deals. I got brand new Lazy Boy office chairs for $5 a piece. They were overstock. I swear. My reception desk was $25 from a nail salon going out of business. So I got a ton of deals. I probably furnished my office for about $500, excluding the technology.
That is remarkable.
Yeah. Now, when it came to technology, I wasn't so cheap because, you know, you have to have the best printer, the best scanner to really have an efficient office. So I think a lot of people know the ScanSnap iX500. That is the best scanner, in my opinion, out there on the market.
Yep, that's what I have.
Yep, I've got one of them. I've got pretty quick laser printer and a desktop computer for the reception station and a laptop for me.
Okay. And are you a PC or an Apple person?
I am a PC person. I do have an iPhone, but for the life of me, I can't figure out a Mac computer.
Okay, well, we can still be friends. So, all right. So now you've got your office open and you're incorporated as an LLC. You furnished it for $500, which I think is fabulous. Mm-hmm. And how did you go about getting your first clients?
So something that I had learned in my research was to do an announcement that I was opening my own office, mainly to friends and family, people that I already knew, not to, you know, other law firms, because what do they care that, you know, competition is opening next door, but to my friends, my family, my current clients, not my current clients, my current students and my former students. And the idea, it seemed a little pretentious to me to write a letter that said, hey, I'm opening my office, look at me. But in reality, I wrote that letter in a way that said, just want to let you know that I'm opening my office. These are my practice areas. I'd love to serve you or your family members. If you can think of anyone that can use my service, let me know. And 8 of my 10 first clients were either people that had received that announcement or they were referred by friends or family that had received that announcement.
So, in fact, it did work.
It did.
Well, you know, a lot of people these days are going towards building an email list. And so one of the ways to populate that email list is to put all your friends and family and everybody you know on that list and send them your first email blast. And so in some ways it's very similar. You created a database of people that you know and you sent out an announcement. And that was a physical mailing you did?
It was.
Great. And then were you already prepared for the question of how do you charge your clients? How do you bill them? Or, you know, what do you, how do you price your services?
So from the very beginning, I decided that what I wanted to focus on was giving my clients a flat rate fee for pretty much any type of law, and especially immigration law and estate planning. They lend themselves to flat fees. I know how much work generally is going to be involved. And so from the very beginning, that's where I started.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of movement towards, you know, flat fees for many legal services. And mm-hmm. I think you're spot on with that, because it's something that the legal consumer can wrap their arms around pretty easily, and they understand more so than, you know, what is an evergreen retainer and what is my escrow account and what can I anticipate for billing. But do you keep an hourly option available to you for those cases that might warrant it?
I do. And even when I do the flat fees, I do keep my hours. And in my contract, I say that this is your flat fee, but I earn my fee at a rate of $300 an hour. And that protects me. For example, if I have an immigration case and halfway through that client decides they don't need my services anymore, well, I can show my work and say that I've already spent this many hours, and so I'm entitled to this much of the fee in refund, whatever hasn't been used.
And also, it's a really good practice to get into so that you can then tweak your flat fees based on the actual hours that these types of cases cost you to perform.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you have any staffing? You said you had a reception area. Do you have staffing yet?
I just hired my very first assistant, and that was also a long process. I took a lot of time deciding what kind of person I wanted to have that role.
Well, take us through that decision tree. What were you considering, and what did you end up deciding upon?
So for my practice, about 25% of my clients are Spanish-speaking, and I find that that's growing. And so I really needed an assistant that would be able to speak Spanish fluently, just as good, if not better, than I can. And also to translate documents. They have to be able to read and write Spanish. Now, the other 75% of my clients are English speakers. So the trick was to find an assistant that was just as fluent in English as Spanish.
Sure.
And that's a tall order. Something that I got from the American Immigration Lawyers Association was kind of a skills assessment. And what this was a couple scenarios that your applicant had to draft a response to, an email response. So I'll give you an example. In immigration law, we need a lot of documents. We need passports. We need copies of driver's license, copies of social security cards, etc. So the first scenario would be, Miss So-and-so came into our office. We need these things from her. Can you draft an email to her in either English or Spanish asking for those things? Then the follow-up email would be, she brought in X and Y, but she didn't bring in Z. Can you craft another email to her following up? And just those types of things, just to make sure that the applicants were proficient in communicating in a way that was professional and the clients could understand.
So did you already know what type of staff you wanted to add? I mean, were you looking at a paralegal or a receptionist or an office manager or some combination of the above?
Well, I'm a teacher, and so I felt like anybody that had a really good attitude and a good work ethic, I would be able to train to do my processes. And so I felt like I really didn't need a paralegal, especially for immigration law, because it's such a specialized area of the law. I figured that I could teach someone what all of my practices were, from opening a case to closing a case. And so I was far more concerned with their personality and their work ethic and their ability to communicate in written and spoken English and Spanish.
Interesting. Now, I'll give you a little tip, since you've got a new hire here, that I believe both Chris Berry and Victor Medina, two of our very early guests on The Law Entrepreneur, have done. They have their staff members, when they come on board, start and draft their procedural manual. So as the staff member learns what their job is, they put it in writing and they continually tweak that procedures manual. So in the process of teaching them, they're also developing the procedures manual. So for when that person then subsequently leaves, they have a written manual on how to do that person's job, which I think is brilliant.
I like that. And I think it's even better to have the employee craft it because it's coming from their perspective, not mine.
Exactly. So it'd be something to think about as you go forward. So has that person started for you or just in the process of onboarding them?
He's just started.
Excellent. Excellent. So tell us what role technology plays in your office. You said you have the latest and greatest Windows-based system. What kinds of technology do you employ? Other than the devices, what role does it play in your practice?
So I am completely paperless. I do keep hard copies of files, but only for original documents that need to be retained or for cases that are going to go to court and will need those original or hard copy documents in court. So I have a Dropbox and I keep all of my client files on Dropbox. I have a case management system. I use MyCase. And
very popular case management system.
Yeah. And I still use Google Voice. I know there are other services out there, but when I started using Google Voice, which was free, and I used my cell phone for my first year of practice. Now I have a landline phone, but I forward that Google Voice number to my landline. And that number can also be forwarded to my cell phone or to any other phone I need to use.
Right. So it gives you essentially a virtual phone line that you can port to any device.
Exactly.
Tell me how you came to choose MyCase.
Well, I tried a number of different management softwares out there. I tried Clio. I tried Rocket Matter. For me, I liked the feel of MyCase, and it was also a less expensive option for me. Clio was a little bit more expensive, and right now, MyCase serves my needs, and I'm looking into ways to use it more because honestly, I don't use every single feature that I could. Something that I'm working on now are case flows. So I have certain types of cases that have different steps we have to take. Well, I can put each of those different steps in a case flow in MyCase, and that's what I'm working on now so that my new assistant, he'll be able to see what needs to be done. We can check off what needs to be done. And it's a lot better than the system that I'm doing now that's more, on my paper and on my notes.
Well, I think that's also true for anybody with respect to their case management system. None of us use it to its full potential. And it's just like any other software package. If you ask people, if you're using Microsoft Word, how much of Microsoft Word are you using? Maybe 10%, maybe 20% of the features that application has. So that's not unusual. And I think it's also not unusual that attorneys are always have their eye out for whether or not there's a better tool coming down the pipeline, mm-hmm. To manage their practice with. So all those things are, I think, typical for new solos. What do you do for billing? I know you do a flat fee. Do you send out an invoice, at the end of the case, or are you taking a down payment in the beginning and the balance at the end? And how do you manage that process?
So obviously the goal is to get as much upfront as possible. So usually I get the full amount upfront. And if not the full amount, then half of the fee upfront. And if I have to set the client up on a payment plan like that, then I make sure that the full payment is due before either we have a trial date scheduled or before, if it's an immigration filing, before we file the application or the petition. And I have never had a situation where I had a client that failed to pay me.
Good for you.
Exactly. And I think it's because of the flat fee. People know what they're signing up for at the very beginning, and they're not shocked by a legal bill after a few months of work that they weren't anticipating or expecting.
All right, Nicole, that sounds great. So tell me a little bit about how you market your firm.
So a lot of my clients find me just through word of mouth because of all that I do, teaching English and volunteering at different clinics and events like that. But one thing that I do in particular is I give presentations to English classes, to churches, and to other groups that are interested. I have two signature presentations. One is called Know Your Rights. It has a few short video clips and it shows you what you should do or how to communicate with the police here in the US, how to assert your rights if you want to. And for a lot of immigrants, they come from countries where the military and the police have complete authority. And it is a novel concept to them that here in America, sure, we have rights. And you can refuse consent. You can refuse to give your consent for the police to search your car or enter your home without a warrant, just to sure protect your privacy. Yep. My other presentation is called Immigration Law 101. I go over how to make sure that you're selecting a good lawyer, how to make sure that lawyer is licensed and hasn't been disbarred or suspended. Then we go over the principal ways that people immigrate to the U.S. through family-based immigration and asylum, things like that. And the last thing we do is we go over ways that undocumented immigrants in the U.S. might be able to obtain some kind of legal status.
So you're basically doing a lot of one-to-many presentations, getting the word out about the service, providing them value in the sense that you're providing this important information to them. And in return, that's the hook to come see you when they need to.
Exactly. And what's perfect for immigration law is that it's a really easy population to target. You know, I'm targeting immigrants. Those are who I want my clients to be. It's a lot tougher if you're in a personal injury practice or even a family law practice. You know, it's a lot harder to find that market. But for immigration law, I find that English as a second language classes are perfect. That's right where I need to be to get my name
out. Does social media play any role in your marketing?
So right now I have a Facebook page for my law firm, Whitaker Legal, and I do use it. I use it to promote my things. Right now I'm thinking about creating a new Facebook page to market just to Spanish speakers, since that's kind of a growing area. The other thing I'm working on, since immigration law, you can practice immigration law in any state in the U.S. if you're barred in just one state. So I have clients in New York, I have clients in Florida, and I'm trying to get more clients online, not just from Maryland, but from other states in the U.S. and work with them.
And virtually. I'm assuming that's because the laws that are governing that practice are federal laws.
Exactly.
So you're obviously an entrepreneur here with your firm and your presentations. What is your best entrepreneurial skill, in your opinion? I'm going to allow you to toot your own horn here a little bit.
You know, it's funny because I don't see myself as an entrepreneur at all. Because to me, I feel like an entrepreneur is selling something. And I know that's not true, but I am just not a salesperson. But when it comes to legal services, our clients come to us because they already need something. We don't necessarily have to sell to them. But to answer your question, I think that I have pretty good communication skills. When I speak, I find that people can relate to me. And, you know, people do business with other people that they know and they like and they trust. And when I teach my English classes and when I go out there and give these presentations, people have a chance to get to know me, you know? And they see my personality. It comes out through my speaking when I give these presentations. And I think they're able to relate to me. They come to trust me and they keep my card for if they ever need me in the future, if they have friends or family who could benefit from my services.
Well, I'm going to suggest that, in fact, you are an entrepreneur and you are selling your practice and you're doing it exactly the way that is consistent with who you are. And your best skills, as you've described them to me, is your credibility, your personality, and your understanding of your clients' problems. And those are classic techniques for marketing a professional services firm such as yours. So I think you're doing, you may not think of it as sales, but I think you're doing exactly that and exactly the right way for you. And obviously it's paying off for you.
Well, that sounds good to me.
Terrific. Well, listen, Nicole, it's been a delight having you on our show. I wish you the best of luck going forward. We're going to keep our eye on Whitaker Law. Tell our listeners how they can reach out and contact you should they need to.
Sure. So my website is www.whitaker-legal.com. That's Whitaker, Whitaker-legal, legal.com. And my email address is Nicole, Nicole, at Whitaker-legal.com.
And I know that you have a number of your seminars coming up around the Baltimore area. So if people want to check into your website and see your schedule, they can come out and listen to you. And so again, Nicole, I want to thank you ever so much for being on The Law Entrepreneur, and I wish you the best of luck going forward.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there you have it, fellow law entrepreneurs. Thank you for listening and being a part of today's program. The utmost compliment you could pay me is to go over to iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, and leave a strong 5-star review if you think the podcast and what we're trying to do here is worthwhile. Feel free to share the link to the podcast with your friends, family, and coworkers. I would be very appreciative if you did. So until next time, thanks again for listening to The Law Entrepreneur.